caused the financial crisis.
Right now, what we're looking at is the mortgage side of it, and we're trying to attempt to. Is it up?
Yep.
Again, today is July 21, 2010. Tom Krebs, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and we're here to talk to Mr. Joseph Swartz. Is it Joseph or Joe?
You can call me. Okay.
Bob Hinckley is accompanying me, as is Kim Schaefer. This interview will be recorded, and Mr. Swartz, would you please agree to have this recorded in our presence so that I have it on the record?
Yes, I agree.
All right, sir. We are federal agents for purposes of the Section 18 U.S.C. Section 1001, which makes false statements given to federal employees a crime. I don't anticipate that, but I am required in each and every one of these interviews to advise folks of that. We're going to ask you some questions, but I understand perhaps at first there may be some briefing you wish to give us with respect to overview of the due diligence process, and we would very much like to watch that.
Okay, great.
If you don't understand any of my questions, just tell me I don't understand it. And if you want to take a break at any time, just tell me, or you or your counsel, and we'll be glad to accommodate you. But let's, without any further ado, let's go ahead and look at the overview of this due diligence process you have.
Okay, great.
For us.
This is a summary of the due diligence that we would typically do on a pool of mortgage loans that we would purchase. And starting at the very top, the trade was negotiated between the trader and the originator or the seller, the lender. I would be contacted by the trader and informed that they're bidding on a trade, and I would receive a bid sheet from the trader, which would indicate what the sample size of the trade would be. That sample size was typically negotiated between the seller and the investor, in this case Deutsche Bank. So I had my mandate to go ahead and begin due diligence on a pool of loans at a specified percentage of loans that I would be reviewing for the due diligence. Our vendor was the Clayton Group. Clayton Group was one of the larger due diligence vending firms that were operating at that time. I had been with Freddie Mac prior to coming to Deutsche Bank, and we had used the Clayton Group at Freddie Mac. So I was very familiar with Clayton, many of its managers and people, and its systems and processes. I had actually used the Clayton system while I was at Freddie Mac. I was part of a alternative markets group at Freddie Mac. We concentrated on subprime, Alt-A lending, and manufactured housing lending, so those three areas. So I was familiar with Clayton, and when I came to Deutsche Bank, Clayton was their designated vendor as well. So I was very familiar with the entire process, and I was given a new client services manager that I worked with very closely, and got to know the Clayton Group very well. Many underwriters, many supervisors, many managers very well. The review really tested for three primary areas. When we wanted to review a pool of loans that we were thinking of purchasing, and again, they're in 1, 2, 3 order, but I'll mention verification of loan data first. That's really kind of the first area that I wanted to discuss. We wanted to make sure that the tape, and I call it a tape, but it's an Excel spreadsheet that has all the loan data on it. We get that from the seller. We want to make sure all that loan data is correct. Borrower information, property information, interest rates, everything about the loan. So we have to validate and make sure that information is correct. So the Clayton Group's underwriters will go into the loan file itself, to the actual loan documentation, and they will compare all those different fields, whether it's borrowers' names, addresses, interest rates, LTVs, debt ratios. They'll look at the actual documents, and then they'll compare it back to the tape or the Excel spreadsheet that we receive. And they will make sure that there's consistency with all the data. If there isn't consistency, there's a flag. And at the end of the review, we would get a report called a data discrepancy report. And that would indicate to us what fields on the tape were not accurate. And that was very helpful to us. I would send that into our collateral analytics area, and they would review those discrepancies. So we reviewed any data discrepancies that we would find between the loan tape and the loan file. The next step, which is really number one, the underwriter would determine if the loan was underwritten according to the guidelines of the seller. Sellers publish guidelines, and
Joe, when you say underwriter, you're referring to the person in Clayton.
The Clayton underwriter. That's correct.
Yeah, we call them grunts. We understand
right.
the term.
Okay. Right. So they would we would provide the Clayton Group with the seller's guidelines. We would contact the seller and we would say we need the guidelines for the loans that were originated in this pool, because sometimes those loans may have been originated 3 months ago and they have since made a change to their guidelines. So we would always ask them, we need the guidelines specifically, and sometimes we would get two sets. We might have certain sets of loans that were applicable to one set of guidelines, another set of loans applicable to a second set of guidelines. So the Clayton Group had the guidelines of the seller, and the underwriters would go through the loan file to make sure that the characteristics of the loan with respect to the credit score and the loan to value and the debt to income ratio and the loan amount all conformed to the seller's guidelines, because we were basically purchasing those loans based on the guidelines that the seller provided. The third area is really a subjective area. It's a reasonableness test. And that's something that I continue to work on as time went on, meaning how do you determine that this loan is a good loan or is reasonably originated in the best interest of the borrower, and that there's an ability for that borrower to repay that loan? So that's what a reasonableness test is. You want to look at the loan and say, is there anything here that is out of the ordinary or that really is atypical in lending standards? So, and you see a couple of items here. For example, you know, looking at a borrower's income, looking at their occupation, looking how long they've been employed, and trying to make a determination, does that income look reasonable based on how long that borrower's been working on that job? Looking at the incomes and the assets of the borrower, and then looking at the amount of the mortgage and seeing, does that look like it's reasonable? Does it look like this mortgage is affordable for the income bracket that that borrower is in? And what we would try to do as well is get updated credit information on the borrower. That was very helpful to us because, as I mentioned, many of these loans were originated anywhere from the last 30 to 60 days up until maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 months ago. So we would know that credit scores moved and shifted pretty quickly, and especially in subprime. Subprime borrowers can have dramatic shifts in their credit from month to month. So we would refresh the credit scores of the borrowers, and we would get updated credit bureaus. So if I found that the FICO score when the loan was originated had drifted much lower, and I had a score maybe that was 100 points lower today than it was 3 months ago, I want to know why. What happened to that borrower? That could affect my loan. So I actually would pull up the credit bureau, and I would see, for example, he's past due on several credit cards, or he's past due on an auto loan. So I would flag that loan, and I would have the Clayton Group review that loan. We did kind of a pre-due diligence review inside Deutsche Bank. I had a team of people that assisted me, and I like to try to find underwriters to bring in for my team, people that understood how to look at loans and credit bureaus. And we would run through credit bureaus hour after hour after hour through hundreds and hundreds of loans on loans that had drifted to see, is there anything about this credit of the borrower that is alarming? We might open it up, and there may be only 2 trades or 3 trade lines on a borrower. High FICO score, but only 3 trades, very little credit history. So you find out the borrower is maybe only 23 or 24 years old and is buying their first home, and it's a home that's $700,000. So, you know, again, the credit bureau, to me, kind of opened our eyes up in many ways. So we were able to really look into that loan before we even were on site to do due diligence and kind of see any concerns we had about borrowers whose credit had shifted since the loan was originated. So that was a big component to our pre-due diligence review, something that was very helpful to us.
Is the reasonableness determination done strictly by Deutsche Bank and then followed up with Clayton, or does Clayton do one first and kick it out to you?
Well, the review that we're doing is strictly based on the tape information we have and the updated credit bureau and credit information. The reasonableness test is really based on Clayton's review. Clayton will have access to that borrower's income. The application will show the income, the employment, any dependents, what kind of expenses. All I have is a credit bureau. I can see the borrower's expenses in front of me. So the reasonableness test is conducted by Clayton. They provide us with their findings, and then we have to make a decision if we either agree or disagree with Clayton's findings.
With respect to a particular tape or guidelines published by the seller, do you respond to them and give them tolerances within those guidelines?
In some cases, the trading desk would say that they would put bid stipulations and say, well, we can't buy any of this type of a product, or we're only going down to this level of a FICO score. So in some cases, that's correct. We would put what we would call a little overlay on top of the guidelines saying that while you originate to these guidelines, we're just putting in these restrictions that we're not going to buy loans that still fall within your guidelines, but if we find any of these with these characteristics, for example, I can mention condo tells. There were originators that were originating condo tells in their guidelines, but we didn't want to purchase those types of loans at one point in time, so we excluded those on a bid sheet. We would say minimum FICO score, it may be 500, it could be 550, or in some cases, we would say if the FICO score drifted based upon our review, we have the opportunity to remove loans from the pool if the drift exceeded a certain threshold. So we would put in certain types of parameters. Sometimes the trader would be responsible for doing that. I would not be responsible. It would be, again, negotiated during the bidding process between the trader and the originator what types of restrictions we may want to put around their guidelines that we may not be comfortable with. However, for the most part, we purchase loans to the underwriting guidelines of the originator without too many overlays.
I didn't mean to get you off your
that's
presentation.
Okay. No, that's fine. Sure.
This is meant to be interactive with this.
Right.
At any I have a feeling it's going to be.
Yeah. So, again, the reasonableness determination, we're looking at risk ultimately. You know, Deutsche Bank is looking for me to protect the bank and to try to identify loans in the pool with high risk, loans that have high risk that may be outside of the guidelines, or loans with high risk that are within the guidelines that we feel just are not appropriate, two different types of loans. So it was my job to try to remove those loans from the pool and try to let the bank know pretty much my thoughts about the review itself when it was completed, you know, my overall thoughts about a review. So that pretty much kind of gives you a high-level overview of what the Clayton Group would do when they would go in to review a pool of loans for us. And do you
on
have any questions?
Side, right,
this is just on the credit side. There were really two pieces to the review, the credit compliance review, which was conducted by Clayton, and then I had a separate valuation review that we were reviewing the properties and the property values and appraisals. So two reviews taking place simultaneously. In some cases, I would use Clayton for both reviews. In some cases, I would use another valuation vendor for the value review. First American CoreLogic, Hansen, there were some big value vendors that did a very good job in helping me to establish supported appraised values. So two reviews going on simultaneously, and sometimes I would use the Clayton Group for both. Sometimes I would use separate vendors for each. If you want to turn to the next page, these are overlays that I begin to create, and I created them over time. I created these overlays for the underwriters at Clayton to try to, again, identify risk that they ordinarily might not be identifying. Most due diligence firms were going in when they were reviewing loans, and they would find exceptions to the guidelines. However, we did find issues with loans that were within guidelines, so I started implementing certain types of overlays to Clayton to try to help the Clayton underwriters identify those loans, bring them back on a spreadsheet, flag them for Deutsche Bank to review. So to give you an example, first is minimally acceptable FICO. I set a range, I believe it might have been around 550, and I would say any borrower with an exception under 550, no matter how small that exception is, I want to flag that loan for review. Going under a 550 credit score, you're getting into extremely adverse credit to the point where you really want to question the borrower's ability to have credit at all. So I would set that threshold, meaning that any borrower, regardless of what the issue was, no matter how small or how immaterial it was, if that FICO fell below 550, I wanted Clayton to flag it on a what we would call an open issues list. They would go in and perform the review and then provide to me a list of all the loans they felt were problematic. Either there were exceptions to the guidelines or subjectively they felt the loan wasn't reasonable. I said minimally accepted LTVs. Any first-time home buyers that 100% LTV I want to look at, no matter if there are no exceptions or not, because again, you've got a borrower that's never had a home, that's putting really no equity into that property, and that in itself is a very high risk type of a scenario, where you've got a borrower that has never had a home and has no equity and is financing 100% of the purchase. In addition, you all are very much aware, I'm sure, of the stated income documentation issues. What I would do is I would have Clayton prepare, at the end of the review, a list of all the stated income borrowers that they reviewed. And they would list the borrower, they would list the occupation, they would list the time on the job, and they would list the incomes the borrowers were stating. Because I wanted to be able to have my team to look at all the stated income borrowers in that pool and immediately see which ones they believed would be a problem from a reasonableness point of view, a teacher earning $20,000 a month, something like that. So, again, flagging borrowers on fixed incomes. I was very sensitive to elderly borrowers, retired borrowers, borrowers on fixed incomes that were on stated income loans. I really wasn't very tolerant with those, and I felt that you had borrowers here whose incomes could not really increase due to the fact that they were elderly and probably couldn't go back out into the workforce. They were on a fixed income, and they're taking on an obligation, and I don't know what their fixed income is. So I would reject those loans, and I would look very carefully at those loans. I would look at the borrower's credit. I would look at how long they've been in the home, any activity with refinancing. So again, areas of high risk, and also areas, I was on Freddie Mac's predatory lending committee, so I'm very sensitive to predatory lending. So to me, some of my sellers would come back and say, you can't start discriminating with elderly borrowers. I say, I'm not discriminating. These borrowers already have their mortgages. I just have to decide whether I want to purchase that mortgage if I felt you originated it appropriately or inappropriately. So, again, I was also flagging borrowers with high levels of revolving debt. Stunned sometimes to see borrowers that would have $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 of credit card debt and yet had very high FICO scores and were paying all their bills. But to me, those levels of debt were such that the borrowers probably would never, ever be able to repay them. Eventually, they would have to probably walk away from that debt. So, again, I would have them flag all borrowers. I think it was $50,000 or more in credit card debt. And while $50,000 may sound like a lot, I had levels up to $100,000, $110,000 of credit card debt. So all levels, borrowers were very levered out there. Leverage was really increasing at a phenomenal rate over the last 3 to 4 years before the crisis began. No ratio loans. These were loans that would come in, I'd have no income. How do you conduct a reasonableness test or an ability to repay on a borrower where you don't know how much they're earning? That's very hard to do. So I came up with a method. I said, why don't we just add up all their expenses? Let's add all their expenses, including their mortgage debt. Let's divide that number by 50, and that gives me an estimated income for that borrower at a 50% debt ratio. So that was the test that I had on no-ratio loans, and that was a very difficult experience because I was rejecting loans because of an estimated income I was coming up with, and sellers took great exception to that. They said, these are no-ratio loans. There is no income. You're making assumptions now that you know the occupation, and you're making an assumption on the income, and you're saying it doesn't match, and you're rejecting a loan. And I just held my ground, and I said, well, that's the only test I can do to determine the ability of that borrower to repay the loan. So, very difficult putting somebody, especially re-FICOing, going back in and pulling new credit and then rejecting a loan because the borrower was now delinquent when he wasn't arranged with huge issues with some of the sellers. But again, it was the only way I could really identify current risk and identify risk that with these products where there was really nothing to really go on. very, very difficult to do that, very challenging to try to understand a loan. I had done lending for about 15 years prior to going to work with Freddie, and that was all full documentation at that time. We had no real estate loan. So to me, it was all very foreign, and we prided ourselves on being able to look at a credit bureau without a score and understanding that borrower and that borrower's ability to repay and their willingness to repay. Those are the two big items when you lend. So, again, these were new products to me and very foreign, and most people really didn't understand, even though they claim they may have, very difficult to understand how these products were going to perform, because it was really new territory where we were providing 100% financing to so many Americans out there that had never owned a home before. So it really was... something that we were all looking at very carefully and very closely and kind of wondering, you know, what the end result was going to be. So again, these were, you can see, different things that I tried to do. Flag borrowers to refinance within the last 10 months. You know, there was so much churning going on in the marketplace. You know, the large originators continue to have to source leads and source new borrowers. And I would see borrowers that were refinancing three times in a year, four times in 15, 16, 17 months, stripping equity. So any borrowers who refinanced within the last 10 months were flagged automatically. I want to look at them. And if I felt there was any type of churning, equity stripping going on, we would reject those loans. So I added a kind of a predatory oversight to what we were doing at the bank, only because of my experience and the fact that, you know, I had a very... because I came kind of out of consumer finance where, you know, you don't lend money unless that borrower can pay you back. I mean, that's just a standard. That's the cardinal golden rule of lending in consumer finance. And basically, you know, that test was very hard to analyze in residential mortgages with these types of products. Any questions at all on the overlay?
No.
Okay.
At least from my part.
Okay. These are the reports that the Clayton Group would return back to me after they went on site and reviewed
the loans. Before we go too far, did you cover the 50% authorized user trademark?
No, I didn't. Actually, that's interesting.
Since it's there, I'll ask.
Yeah, okay. I started seeing borrowers' credit reports with authorized trademarks, meaning an authorized user. I think you may have seen that. An authorized user is someone who you give the ability, like I gave my daughter the ability to use my credit card. She shows up as an authorized user, A, on her credit bureau. I started seeing too many credit reports coming in with authorized users, and I noticed those trade lines did match up with the rest of the borrower's credit. I would see maybe an earlier trade line from a Zales or some small retail trade line on a borrower that may have been open, I'm just going to say, maybe in 2000. Then all of a sudden I'd see, and they only have two of those trade lines, then all of a sudden I'd see three in a row, all authorized, Sears, just retail store, Exxon, all authorized user, all kind of open in the same period of time. So we started researching this, and we found out there were companies that were linking together consumers and borrowers, allowing the borrower to link to that consumer's credit card for a short period of time. It was allowed to become an authorized user to build their credit. They needed to have usually three to four trade lines to be approved for a mortgage loan. Two did make it. So adding one or two authorized user trade lines gave the borrower the required amount in order to get the mortgage. So I started discounting those trade lines. I said, I'm not going to use authorized. And I got a lot of pressure back as well, because they said you have no right to start deleting trade lines from a borrower because he's an authorized user. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't reconcile that these are valid trade lines, that these were truly the borrowers. And again, it's understanding credit. You know, many people in my industry hadn't looked at credit bureaus. I looked at credit bureaus back in the 80s. So to me, I grew up on credit bureaus and credit information. So I was very knowledgeable about different repositories, different credit providers. We had a credit provider in San Diego that we excluded because they built a mortgage for a borrower that didn't exist. So, and that credit provider is still providing credit today to sellers in the market. So again, try to do things that I try to source from my background, from my experience in making loans. Something that was somewhat foreign to New York, to Wall Street. They didn't have too many people that had that loan level detailed information with them in my position.
I'm not familiar with this. That's partially because I've been out of the country for a long time. But are you saying that basically there were people set themselves up to put people who needed a credit rating with people who had a credit card,
mm-hmm.
and they would then pay
there would
cash
be a fee. there would be a fee, maybe $1,000, to use my credit card for 3 months, right? And not to charge anything, but you're just authorizing that person to be a user, and then you'll cancel them out after they purchase the home. So there were a lot of things being done by companies out there to circumvent the process of credit underwriting. Okay.
Renting someone else's credit.
These are the reports that were returned after the review from Clayton. Credit event twos. Clayton had a grading system. 1, 2, and 3. 1, no exceptions. 2, there's what Clayton felt was a small exception, immaterial, that usually could be overridden with compensating factors. And 3 was an exception that was outside of the guidelines, or it was egregious enough that even if the loan were within guidelines, they felt that there was a reasonableness issue there or a subjective issue there that made it a 3. So
were there any others?
Well, within the 1, 2, and 3 category, they had, for example, 2 W's and 2 C's.
What were 2 W's?
2 W's are the loans that the Clayton Group would initially have out as a 3, and Deutsche Bank would waive, meaning there was an exception that Deutsche Bank felt, yes, that's an exception to the guidelines, but I believe that that exception does not materially affect the risk of the loan, and we felt we would waive that exception and purchase that loan.
What was the 2C?
Those were usually exceptions that Clayton itself had the authority to make to take a 3 to just a 2, meaning it's an exception. However, it's very material. There were a lot of small compliance exceptions and document exceptions that Clayton would make 2Cs. And I wasn't even aware of a lot of them. They were very small and material. I never got very involved in compliance. I never was allowed to overturn any compliance exceptions that had to be done by outside counsel. So there were always little compliance issues with disclosures or document issues that Clayton's counsel in their system knew the error was immaterial, so they would overturn it themselves.
Based on a history of having that type of thing.
And also
and somebody saying, this will kick out as a 3, but you can turn it into a 2.
And they had Thatcher Prophet advising them to make those decisions, as I had Thatcher Prophet advising me for compliance errors. So whenever I had a compliance question, and sellers would come back to me in many cases because compliance wasn't always black and white, there were gray areas. And you could take positions with respect to compliance across a spectrum. You can be more liberal or you can be more conservative. We tended to be more conservative with compliance, and that sometimes created issues because you can look at a compliance error two different ways. I remember talking to a seller and saying to the seller, my counsel told me that I'm not able to purchase this loan, it's not compliant. And they said, well, our counsel has told us that it is compliant and that the law, the way they're defining it, it's acceptable. So you get sometimes conflicting counsel's opinions that both were somewhat legitimate. But that being said, we would take more of the conservative opinion. That was Deutsche Bank saying that to me, so I always went more right of center than left of center. So
let's go back to 2 W's.
Sure.
So I understand it. This was a 3, which under Clayton's grading system says reject.
That's correct.
But it was waived, whatever the reason for the rejection was waived by Deutsche Bank.
That is correct.
Okay.
Right. And there would always be loans that we would waive. In most cases.
Would you waive them in beforehand? Were there bulk-type waivers that you made?
Well, for example, they would review 500 loans during due diligence, and they would come back with maybe 250 loans with exceptions. So I have about half of my pool now has exceptions of one type or another, credit, compliance, some type of a combination of both. Documentation, I'm missing an application, could be a whole litany of errors. So we would have to work through all these 250 open issues. My team would start working through each one of them, looking at each issue, looking at each borrower, looking at the severity of the issue, and trying to make a determination. Is this exception severe enough? Is it material enough that it would result in us deleting the loan from the pool? Some were, some weren't. Give you an example maybe of one that wasn't. Let's say a debt ratio maximum was 55%, and let's say the debt ratio went up to 60. But let's say that I had a borrower, let's say it's full income documentation. Let's say the borrower has disposable income of, let's say, maybe $4,000 to $5,000 after that ratio. Well, that's a lot of disposable income. and let's say he has a very good credit score, he has a good mortgage history, everything looks good. He's got a lot of debts out there, but he's paying them, and he's got a lot of money left over. So it's not as though he's got low disposable and high debt ratio. That's very important. Where you have a high, where you're very levered, you don't have much money left over for just, you know, utilities, insurance, food, things of that nature. But if he's got a high disposable, good credit, we would make an exception sometimes on a debt ratio. I'm not saying that we would go to 60, but in some cases it could just be a matter of a few percentage points where we would make an exception on. Now, we saw one the other day where it was a safety exception, where the people were having new windows put on the home, so they removed the deck. So when you walked out of the sliding glass door in the back, if you didn't realize it was there, you'd fall maybe 4, 5, 6 feet. Well, that's an exception. So we cleared that exception. We didn't delete the loan because of the safety exception. So they were as small as that, or they could be as large as a stated income loan, where we have a borrower who's stating $10,000 a month, and he says he's a manager with a company, but we don't know what kind of company he is. We don't know if he's a manager over 5 people or 50 people. We have a credit bureau here in front of us. He's never bought a home before. He's a first-time home buyer. He's had a car loan. He's paid that fine. He's had some credit cards. He's paid those fine. But again, you know, you're making that determination. How do you really make a judgment call like that? It is very difficult to do. And unless it really comes out where you can say, well, I know that a licensed practical nurse doesn't make $80,000 a year, if it's something as blatant as that, that's an easy one. But they weren't all that easy. They gave you very generic occupations, and you had no idea how big these companies were that they were working for. So very difficult sometimes to make those assessments. So, you know, there were loans that we had to make a judgment call on, and we tried our best to make the best call we could. And you know, that was our decision. So, yeah, they went both ways. You know, there were two W's that were made for smaller reasons, two W's where we really had to sit there and really think about that reason before we made it. And sometimes after we made it, we just hope that's the best decision we could make. Any other questions? Run it? Okay. Again, the open issues report is that list of exceptions that I mentioned that Clayton would provide back to us. And we would review that exception list, and I would overlay. I would take that open issues list, and we would overlay the refreshed FICO scores. And I would have my team even put the link in so I could pull up the credit bureau when I was reviewing my open issues report. So I wanted as much information to make an educated and a good decision on that loan as I could. Again, the data discrepancy report is a report which matches up discrepancies. And, you know, we did have issues sometimes where we found maybe a systemic discrepancy between a CLTV and an LTV. For example, we found one pool from a seller where they had coded the loan 80% LTV and 80% CLTV, meaning that you would assume the borrower has 20% equity. Well, I was happy to go through a pool one night, and I saw one of the borrowers had drifted considerably in her FICO score. So I pulled up her bureau, and I saw she was a first-time home buyer. She only had 2 credit cards, one of which was already past due. So I looked at the tape, and I saw that she had a $400,000 loan, and it was an 80-80 purchase. I go, wow, that means she bought a home for $500,000 and put $100,000 down. I go, how's this person who's in her young early 20s with 2 credit cards, how did she get that money to put that money down? Well, I pulled up her title online, and she had a second lien behind it. She didn't put any money down. It was an 8100. So here I have a pool from a big seller, and that scared me because I think it's an 88 and it's an 8100. So I started going through. It was 1 in the morning. I'm going through all these loans, seeing that I've got a tape discrepancy here that's very serious. And I found probably another 20 right behind it that had borrowers with second liens out there that wasn't reflected on the tape. So, again, we had to go back to the seller, and we had a major issue with that trade because of that data concern and that data issue. We had to go back and really check a lot of those loans that were the 80-80s. I think I sampled all of them at that point because I didn't trust the data. So, again, data discrepancy, very important, and it would alert us to any material issues such as the CLTV-LTV issue that I just described. Payment history review. Because the sellers had seasoned loans in the pool, and why did they have seasoned loans? Well, they're actively selling loans that they're originating, and they can't sell them to investor B, so they pull it out of that trade and they try to sell it to investor C next month. And if maybe investor C doesn't buy it, then maybe investor D will the following month. So you'll have these loans trailing, and of course seasoned loans are high up on everyone's radar screen. So I would say, in addition to pulling most of those seasoned loans into my review, I would say I want payment histories from you. Any of those borrowers, if they've ever been once delinquent paying you, on not purchasing the loan. So that's something else I kind of had Clayton do. I wanted to have them start providing payment history review, so the seller had to provide payment strings showing the borrower's payments and that they all had to be current. The state and income report I mentioned before, just so that we can see at a glance all the borrowers in the sample that were on stated income to see if there were any that we didn't feel comfortable with that Clayton may not have already rejected. Clayton would provide a final reject list to us after all the loans were reviewed and finalized. And the way it went is my team would work on the open issues. And there was a lot of missing documentation that would result in a rejection. If I didn't have a verification of a mortgage, I would reject the loan. So I would go back to the seller. I would say, there's no verification of mortgage. If you can provide it, we'll purchase the loan. That's the only exception. So for 2 weeks, there was a lot of going back and forth with all these 250 open issues, trying to work through them, decide which ones you really don't want, decide which ones you feel that, you know, you can be flexible with, and those that are kind of in the middle. You're not sure if you want the loan or you don't want the loan. So we would go through this back and forth exchange of information and documentation for several weeks. And then we would set up a phone call. And that phone call would be the tie-out call. And we would go through these 250 issues with the seller, sometimes one by one, and make a determination which loans we keep and which loans we delete. And we always went into the phone call knowing which loans we really didn't want and which loans we could keep, and then those that were kind of on the fence. So it was really, you know, it's negotiation. And there were some investors that would go on site to be actually face-to-face with the seller while you're going through this. I preferred to do it over the phone because I had a lot of tools with me, credit reports, everything else that I could talk about, borrower's intelligence. Plus, I found face-to-face is very hard to delete lots of loans when you're talking to somebody right across the table, and let's say the senior executive is in there from the seller and he's all wants to you to buy as many loans as possible. I didn't like that interaction. Too much pressure. It's that face-to-face. Much easier to say no over the phone 3,000 miles away than it is sitting 3 feet across the table from someone. So we transacted most of my tout calls over the phone. Sometimes they would take 30 minutes. Sometimes they would take 8 hours. We would have to break for lunch, and we'd get right back on the phone and go loan by loan by loan. And sometimes it was adversarial. They want me to keep the loan, and I don't want to keep the loan. I don't think the income's reasonable. They think the income's reasonable. So a lot of time and effort spent. We would have multiple trades during the month. We'd have to schedule everything accordingly, and spending an awful lot of time. We always wanted to be very prepared, and that's one thing our sellers came back and said, Deutsch is always prepared. They know sometimes more about that borrower than we do when we get on the phone with them. So that's how I wanted my team to really know that borrower, and if you're going to reject that loan, you have a very good reason, and it makes sense to me.
Go ahead.
Stepping back, you had used the example of 500 loans and that half of them would be exceptions,
right.
And you'd have to go through the process that you just described so nicely for us. But that was a sample.
Correct.
So what would be the range of possibilities that you're looking at 500 loans out of how large a pool?
Again, sample sizes were negotiated by the trader, and typically if they were familiar with a seller, they would look to lower the sample sizes, because sample sizes really determine issues in the pool, exceptions, what types of loans you're looking at. But sellers knew the more you sampled, the more you're going to reject. So they fought you on sample sizes. They were very, very sensitive about sample sizes. And that was something that we always wanted to sample more. They always wanted us to sample less. So it varied. Some of our small and mid-tier sellers, we would sample 100% of the pool, because these were newer sellers, smaller sellers. The big sellers out there, they carried some leverage with them, meaning they had some weight. You could negotiate to a degree, but if you push too hard, they're going right down to the next investor. And they're going to say, well, if you want 40, I got 10 guys that'll do it at a 30% sample. So, again, it's a negotiated element there.
So, again, continuing with the example you set up of 50% exceptions, if that was, let's say it was at one of the larger institutions where they had more negotiating power, so you were only sampling a third?
Right. Usually it was maybe around 30%. It's very good. That was okay. Kind of an average size, for the most part, for the large sellers.
Fine, 30%. So, 500 sample, half had exceptions, you'd end up kicking out 10%?
Well, see that...
I'm sure it varies.
It really varied. It varied from not only originator to originator, but pool to pool. Sometimes originators would provide pools with sometimes slightly different products, and you would see different credit characteristics and different levels of quality with those different types of pools. And then as time drew on, meaning going from 03 to 04 to 05 to 06, you started seeing the level of issues growing and increasing, and the severity increasing and growing as well. So initially, right, we would work through that loan, and let's say back in 03, maybe those 500 issues or 250 issues would work themselves down to maybe 70 or 80 material issues that you would look to delete from the pool. Maybe by 2006, that had grown to 125 by then. Meaning those issues you saw back in 03, still the incomes didn't seem to be as inflated, that the matching of the borrower to the home didn't seem to be as uneven. But by the time you got to 06 and 07, you were seeing some things that you just, I mean, even being a lender as long as I had, I was still stunned to see the degree at which people were buying homes and refinancing homes and investing in homes.
And the underwriting standards were deteriorating over that period of time.
Most definitely. So what was happening, there was a lot of scoring going on. You know, scoring models made things very efficient. And everything was about efficiency and productivity and getting a mortgage and a home to a borrower as cheaply as possible. You know, everybody's saying it's so expensive. The process is very expensive. And I had sellers that had programs called Quick and Easy, Fast and Easy. So again, taking some of those shortcuts, using models and scoring mechanisms and not really having that human touch of an underwriter really looking at that loan kind of from an art perspective versus a science, definitely, I think, caused a lot of gaps in the risk area that you normally would not have had. You relied on a score or a model or just something telling you that this is appropriate or it's acceptable, but there's just too much to a loan about the borrower and the property. Those are the two elements you really want to get to know. And you can't get to know them sometimes by a score.
Where I was trying to go was, let's say we're late in the game, so you're finding a quarter of this sample that you actually want to reject.
Okay.
125 out of the 500.
Okay.
Right? What happens to the rest that gets purchased?
Yes, the remaining loans would be purchased. And again, when I was picking my sample, my samples were mostly adversely selected, meaning I'm looking to pick out large sections of high-risk loans based on my refinancing, just based on characteristics in the pool, high interest rates. The higher the coupon, you have to assume the higher the risk in that loan. 100% financing, no equity, high risk. First-time home buyer, high risk. Stated income, high risk. Season loans, high risk. So we would combine these elements, and we also would use S&P. We used an S&P model to help us with risk ratios. So we had a lot of different things we used to try to find where is the risk in the pool. Where are the loans in this pool that are very much likely to maybe go into delinquency or default? And then Deutsche Bank would say, Joe, you got 500 loans here. Try to figure out which ones. Yeah, you can pick 150. You can pick 30% the sample. You can pick 150 of them. Try to find which ones you think are the highest risk, and if possible, try to remove those from the pool.
Okay. I had thought it was a representative sample, so that's a helpful insight. Thank
right.
you.
Sure.
You were going to ask a question. You let me go first. This nice gentleman. I apologize if I made you get your question.
Any other report? Did you get reports from Clayton other than these reflected here?
There were value reports. I had an open
issues. What?
Evaluation. I had open issues, credit compliance, and I had open issues, value. See, we would have to look at the property's value. So I would have a different value vendor, and if it was Clayton, Clayton would send me an open issues value report. So that's not really listed on here, the valuation report. But other than that, these were the primary reports that I did receive from Clayton.
Would you meet with the Clayton people from time to time?
Absolutely.
I mean, with respect to a specific deal or for general, just to try to see what's coming.
There were times there were specific deals and times just in general. On-site reviews, due diligence reviews, were done on-site sometimes at the seller's offices or at Clayton's facility in mm-hmm. Tampa. Mm-hmm. The facility in Tampa I liked because I had a dedicated team of Deutsche underwriters there that I would use on every trade. So I spent...
When you say Deutsche, you mean
Clayton employees that were assigned to Deutsche. Right. Whenever there was a Deutsche trade, I'd get
So when you spoke previously about teams, that's what you were referring to, the independent contractors who had been engaged by Clayton to look at a Deutsche deal.
That's correct. I mean, if I was discussing teams before, absolutely, very important. I would go down and spend several days with my team, and I would sit around, we would talk about loans, and I would let them say, if you have a concern about an income, if you have to think about whether it's reasonable or not, reject it.
So you're sitting in a room full of grunts with a couple of QC people right. and a lead manager from Clayton with whom you interact on a as-needed basis.
And again, I wasn't on site as much as maybe other managers may have been, but I did go out on site, and when I was with Freddie, that's all we did. We were on site consistently with the lead and all the underwriters. With respect to the Deutsche Bank, while I was on site, I can remember one large transaction. I met my client services manager there. We spent the entire week. We did the entire review and tied out the entire transaction while we were on site at the originator. But that was the exception to the rule. In most cases, I managed the on-site from New York, and I would call the lead at Clayton on Monday at the start of the job with my client services manager, and we would go over any unusual characteristics I saw with the pool, any areas that I wanted them to focus on, and then I would have conversations during the week with the lead and with my client services manager to kind of get a feel for how the review is going. Do you see anything of a concern, any particular items you want to talk about or mention to me? Has the seller been good in responding to open issues and getting back to you with any concerns you might have? So there was always a lot of interaction going on between myself and Clayton's employees.
What were the leads that you favored more than others?
Well,
Ms. Medina?
Rose Medina. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I can remember being on an on-site with Rose out in California, and she was very capable. In fact, her husband was one of the underwriters on the on-site. We were there. I know I had an issue at one point with Rose during that review, and it was really just, and again, I think I was, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but, you know, we did have, I did have an issue on that review. I can't remember specifically, but I never really excluded anybody. Did I exclude Rose maybe from future reviews? I can't recall, but that's interesting. You mentioned that name. It kind of brings back the memories. But I had some leads that I liked because I was on site with them, and I'd work with them at Freddie, and they were very capable. They were very focused. They managed their people very well. So I would try to get those leads if I could. It wasn't always possible because during the height of the boom, Clayton was very busy, and sometimes
it was the fellow from Benton, Texas?
From who?
Benton, Texas. His name.
There were a lot of people from Texas. Judy Dodson was a favorite lead of mine. She was from Houston.
And Clayton has given us all
these
favorite
names?
Leads, so we
okay.
know that.
Yeah, I know. A lot of names, some of which...
But what I was getting at is, any other documents here that they provided to you?
There may have been maybe a couple of smaller documents, but they only related maybe to the trade itself. Trying to think if there was a tail funding. We would have certain loans on a report that if the seller provided additional HUDs, for example, a missing HUD, that it was like a trailing doc, we would clear that loan. So they would provide a trailing doc report. But these are the primary reports that Clayton would provide to me.
Place for me where your operation fits in Deutsche Bank. Are you the only person that's doing this at Deutsche Bank? Do you have a team of in-house people?
Well, at the time, I had a team of 5 people that were helping me review trades.
Who are they?
Stephanie Camara.
Spell that last name.
C-A-M-A-R-A.
Yes.
Patrick Lachansky. And that's spelled L-A-C-H-A-N-S-K-I. Amit Arora. A-M-I-T. A-R-O-R-A. Anthony Olisa, and that's A-U-L-I-S-A. Jason Skolnick, S-K-O-L-N-I-C-K, and Michael White. And I know that there was some overlapping there. Michael left and Jason took his place. So that was my team. I only have Jason up today.
What was your title?
My title when I started with Deutsche Bank in March of 03, I was vice president.
Okay.
And I became a director 2 years later.
And so all RMBS trades that Deutsche was part of, in terms of turning them into RMBS, came through this team of yours?
Passed through my gate.
Passed through your gate.
From
okay.
March of 03 until August of 07 when we had our last trade.
All bulk loan.
All bulk loan purchases, correct.
And they were for the purpose of securitizing them and selling them as securities?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Well, when we left off, we were asking, any more reports?
No, these are the
results. Summary of results, what was that?
The Exhibit 1 is, actually, turn the page. This is the summary I would get from Clayton. This was the high-level summary that really everybody was interested in. After the trade, everybody wanted the Exhibit 1. Rating agencies, my senior managers, everybody wanted to take a look at these exhibits to kind of get a feel for how the trade went. And you can see from this trade, if you look at the very bottom, at the last line, it says total bid pool. Well, the bid pool was 1,772 loans, and it was about $225 million UPB. You can see where it has total sample size, right in the middle of the page there with a little A next to it. 535 loans. That was the number of loans I sampled on this trade with a UPB of $82 million. The UPB's percentage of the pool, about 36-37% of the pool. If you go to the middle section, and that's for credit and regulatory compliance. So for credit and regulatory compliance, which Clayton would be conducting, they looked at 535 loans in this pool. Now you look at the middle section, your property valuation. Total sample size, you'll see 421. So in addition to looking at 535 loans for credit and compliance, I looked at 421 loans from a value perspective, meaning I had someone drive by the property and give me a valuation with comparables, because I ran all of my loans on every trade through an AVM model. And from that AVM model, I made a determination of what loans I needed to elevate for further
AVM.
AVM is automated valuation model.
Got it.
Right. I would run the loans, and I'd get an AVM back. An AVM is an estimate of the value of a home, but it's only an estimate, and it's a model.
So you would get this pool, mm-hmm. and basically you'd employ Clayton to put people in cars and drive around and do, buy evaluation.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we would they would take pictures and do valuation. So I had really two reviews going on simultaneously: the credit and regulatory compliance review, and the property valuation review.
They did drive-bys.
They did drive-bys. That's correct.
And how long would it take for these two reviews to be conducted, given the numbers that you have here?
Usually there's about a 2 to 3 week time frame from start to finish, probably closer to 3 weeks, because the drive-bys would take 1 to 2 weeks themselves just to come back. And maybe I'll...
And my understanding is that Clayton would put as many people on as it took to meet the deadline. Is that...
That's correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. In some cases, though, they had to politely decline. Very few, very, very rarely happened, but sometimes they came back and said, "Joe, we're booked. We can't provide coverage for the trade," and I would go to a second vendor, but that was very rare. So basically, you can see that I looked at a fairly good piece of this specific pool here, a nice percentage both for the credit and for the valuation review. Then if you go to the top, you'll see deletions. And the very first item are credit-related deletions, meaning credit guideline violations. In this case, you can see there were 53 loans that I rejected for just credit guideline violation. I had 61 loans that were just compliance-related violations. There were an additional 31 that had both a credit and a compliance exception. And you'll see 35 loans where those are ability to repay. And those are loans typically that are within guidelines that are rejected because of a Deutsche Bank review, a subjective review. So And then falling below is the value rejections. Out of the 421 loans that I had drive-bys on, 119 were rejected. And then that little negative 11 there, there were 11 loans in the value rejections that were also up in my credit compliance. So in order to avoid duplicating and counting a loan twice, I pull 11 out. So my net here at the top is 288 rejections, which was 17, almost 18% of the pool. And this is by UPB, or almost 34% of my sample. Now, this pool is a little bit different because we found out during the course of the review that the seller had put non-compliant loans into my pool knowingly. And that was a problem for me. And again, I really looked at all originators pretty evenly, even though there were stories and things said about originators for whatever the reasons were. I didn't really try to have any biases going into a review. I really let the review itself dictate what my thoughts and feelings would be about an originator. So when we found out that we had these compliance rejections that they had, actually, Clayton had seen these loans before. That's how I got the message. They had seen these loans on a prior trade. They were rejected, and now the seller put them back into my pool. So I had to go and I had to upsize my sample. I had to look at more loans because I didn't trust them now with respect to compliance. Plus, I told them, you have to tell me now all the loans in the pool that you are aware of. So you can see additional compliance rejects, lender compliance rejects. So you can see there were a significant number of additional loans in this pool that we had to delete.
All right, show me, what were you looking at?
At the bottom.
At the very bottom here, where it has the three lines, bid stip rejects, which is FICO drift, additional compliance rejects, which resulted from my additional review, and then lender compliance rejects, where the lender came forward and voluntarily told us these loans are non-compliant. They weren't allowed to do that. The agreement stipulates they shouldn't be knowingly put any rejected loans or loans outside of their guidelines into a pool. So basically, you can see that if you added up the 17% at the top and added up these three categories here, 7.9%, because when they did that, we took a very harsh view of them and we rejected that FICO stip. Ordinarily, we wouldn't do something like that where we just carte blanche, removed all these loans just based on a drift, because sometimes the drift wasn't really reasonable. And we didn't care at this point. They did that to us, so we said, all bets are off. So I just deleted everything as much as I really could. And you can see it looked like about 30% of the pool we ultimately ended up rejecting. So this was kind of somewhat of an adverse review where, you have a circumstance where a seller does something to you that is unacceptable. So this
did it take place later in the game? Or
this was in September of 2006. And this was a seller that I had visited with Freddie and was approved with Freddie, and we had insured some of their securitizations. So, again, even your best supposedly originators out there had gaps and lapses in their processes and policy, which were really not acceptable.
Did you continue to do business with this seller?
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but after that being said...
Who was this seller?
CIT.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sure. How long have you been with Deutsche Bank, John?
March of 2003. It'll be 8 years this March.
And basically, the size of your team has been the same throughout, except that now it's shrunk, obviously.
I only have one left.
Yeah.
Right. So it started out with just me, and then I added Patrick Leshansky, and then I added Stephanie Kamara. See, I had to keep adding as we got busier. I had to keep adding people.
Yep.
Right.
Okay.
So this exhibit really was the summary of the trade, and this would really kind of give everybody some insight as to how well the trade or how poorly the trade may have gone.
And how many trades would you do a month?
Well, it depended. In 2003, we may only have been doing maybe 10 to 20 trades a month. By 2006, it could be 50 to 100 trades a month. So it really got much busier as the years drew on.
Got it.
Right.
And when you say trades a month, what are you talking about? 20
individual bulk loan purchases, meaning I purchased 5 pools from Countrywide, 10 pools from Option One. So all those totaled up between 50 to 100 trades. I think maybe in 1 month in 2006, we may have neared almost 100 trades in a month.
And these trades there's not a one-to-one correlation between a trade and a securitization RMBS.
Well,
sometimes there is, sometimes...
Right, if the trade is very large, if it's a $1 billion trade, then we can actually take that, and that'll be a single securitization with an option one tag on it, or a Fremont tag, or a New Century tag. But most were aggregated. Most we took groups of originators' loans, and we securitized them. They were aggregated securitizations.
Right. Okay.
I'll talk a little bit about property value due diligence. Again, you know, that's an area that has been probably the most challenging today, in this environment today. Credit seems to be controlled today. Valuation still definitely, while it's come a long way, I know it's still a very challenging area today. But most sellers, including Deutsche Bank, would run 100% of the pool through an AVM model, an automated valuation model. And to give you an example, Freddie Mac has supposedly the strongest AVM model in the industry. It's called Home Value Explorer, HVE. And supposedly, because of all the data Freddie has, those AVMs, that you put your address in there, the value coming back should be kind of close to what your property may be worth. So we had our choices of AVMs. You know, Freddie had an AVM, First American had an AVM, Veros Value. There were maybe about 8 AVMs on the market. And you could choose between those AVMs. And you know, you're always wondering which ones to choose, which ones to put first, second, third. So I relied a lot on my valuation vendors to help me decide, you know, which types of AVMs to use. Sometimes they told me using AVMs geographically would be valuable. So CoreLogic developed what they called a geo-AVM waterfall for me. They designed AVMs that seemed to work better in certain parts of the country. So if I'm pulling an AVM in the southeast, they might put me on a value finder. Or if I'm in the west, I might be on Freddie's. So First American, CoreLogic usually would be the ones that would determine my waterfall of AVMs. And I pretty much use First American, CoreLogic almost exclusively for my AVM. So here I have 500 loans.
Sounds like that's just a pass-through to somebody. They were just creating a pass-through to direct you to where
First American, right? They had First American had the waterfall, and I would use First American. They would have Freddie, and they'd have their own proprietary AVM. They have competitors' AVMs, Veros Value, Basis Solimar. So they had a host of AVMs for me to use. So I have 500 loans. I run them through the AVM model, and back come all my values. So now I'm comparing my AVM value with my appraised value. How do they match up? If my variance is too large, I'm going to want somebody to drive by the house and tell me, is that appraised value supported? So basically, the first measurement we use, how many loans have a variance greater than 15% of the appraised value? That was the flag. That was kind of the industry's flag, that if it was greater than 15%, you probably wanted to elevate it for review. Not all the time, but in most cases you did. So.
Okay, so you're saying, what you're saying is each of these outfits had models, and what the models did more or less was just plug in the number of bedrooms, bathrooms, and the address? Is that how it worked? Or?
Well, the models would be drawing on databases on home sales, other appraisals that had taken place, and sales in the area, comparables.
Yeah.
Like First American is pulling in all the homes around that property and what they sold for, and then it's trying to zero in, and it's looking at the room counts, the bedrooms, and then it's coming up with some type of a value.
And
sometimes.
Didn't the appraisers generally have the same models?
Interesting. I never knew the appraisers to use AVMs. They really, in a way...
But when you get appraisal, it has comparables and...
Well, they should be doing it through multiple listing services.
Okay.
They shouldn't be going to an AVM for that. In fact, the appraisal industry probably looked at an AVM with a skewed eye. They said, you know, you're trying to get a model to tell you what the value of that property is. I'm an appraiser. I'll tell you what the value of that property is. And in fact, the BPOs we were using were real estate brokers, and the appraisal industry kind of got left behind. Real estate brokers picked up the pace with these, what they call broker price opinions. Those were the drive-bys that we ordered. And I was at an appraisal conference a year ago, and I talked to the appraisers because I felt bad that the appraisers were no longer part of that process, that they had reverted back to real estate brokers, because I believe appraisers are truly value people, and real estate people are good in some sense. But that being said, we would order these drive-bys based on AVM return values, and then the drive-by values would come back. So I now have two values. it wasn't going to be Deutsche Bank that was going to try to determine which value was supported. I would now have to pay an appraiser to do a reconciliation of my BP, my drive-by, and my appraisal. So I would have an appraiser sit there, and he would look at both of these valuations, and then he would come back to Deutsche Bank, and he would say, okay, Joe, in this case, I believe your drive-by better represents your value. The appraised value is $200,000. Your drive-by is $150,000. I think this property is worth $160,000. So that's my value now. So now I have to go back to the seller and say, I believe this property is worth $160,000. You had a 90% LTV on this, and your value was $200,000. Now my LTV is over $100,000. I can't accept this mm-hmm. loan. Okay. So they would say, no, we don't believe the value is $160,000. They say, well, if you don't believe it, then you talk to the appraiser. I'm not going to discuss it. Don't argue with me about that. You got to talk to a professional. So that was good that I kind of took that away from our team, because initially when I first got to the bank, the process was me going through that exercise with appraisers on the other line and looking at the BPO and the appraised value. And I said, you know, as good as many as appraisals I've looked at, I looked at thousands of them. I really don't want to be in this position to come up with a value. So that's when I transferred it back to the vendor, and I said, I'll pay extra, but I want him to do the rec, and I want him to get on the phone with the seller, and the appraisers can discuss it among themselves, because he's not going to give if he doesn't feel the appraiser's giving him reliable information to change that value. So that was really the value process, it was very robust, but again, I focused a lot on, my team was focused on the credit, and I let my vendors kind of work through the values. And then they would come back to me and say that these are the values. I would talk to the seller. I would say, okay, the values are what they are. These are rejected, and maybe I'll keep these two because I've got a great borrower here, and I feel very good about the credit. So I've got a higher LTV than I expected. I'm okay with that loan. So we would clear values as well based on the credit of the borrower. You just couldn't look at it from one side. If you had a property whose value wasn't supported, it wasn't necessarily a rejection. You wanted to look at the borrower and basically the history of that borrower, and put both together and say, okay, now I've got both the borrower and the property. What's my risk look like? Is this acceptable or is it unacceptable? So,
a natural place. Can we take a break whenever it makes sense?
Surely.
For you?
I'm going to grab that. Turn it off. Right. What time is it?
2:30. 2:20.
2:25.
Just tell him 2:20 and then get off the button.
We have to keep from the machine.
Good. Super. Michael Camerato, I want you to tell me where he fits into this overall, too. I mean, not now, okay. But we'll do that when we get married.
So